Oh, hey there. I'm Guy Branum, and welcome to Pop Pocket, a weekly show picking over all the pop culture we love to love. With me to talk TV, film, music, and anything else entertaining, our digital strategist, Winter Mitchell.
Hello, hello.
Hello, hello. Journalist Margaret Wappler.
Hi, Guy. How you doing?
Hello, Margaret. I'm doing all right. It's very springy out there in Los Angeles right now.
It's true.
And academic and DJ, Oliver Wang. For a moment in this lighting, I thought it said academic and socialite. And
if only I can only
and
wish.
And socialist.
Yes, that too. That too.
Coming up on this week's show, we're going to be answering your pop culture questions because it's a mailbag show.
Woo!
Always fun. Plus, we'll each be sharing our latest jams. But first, let's find out what arts and entertainment news or events have caught our attention this week. Oliver Wang, what are you all about this week?
The day this episode airs is on a Wednesday. At least it should be, barring something unforeseen. And it will be a really amazing night in professional basketball because both Kobe Bean Bryant will be playing his very last game as a Lakers and Staples Center, not very far from where we're taping. Whether you love or hate him, he has had a remarkable career. And even though I'm glad he's retiring just because he should not be playing professional basketball anymore, I will be sad that he will not be a part of the league. I'm very curious as to what his post-retirement career will look like.
Mm-hmm.
But tonight will be a night to celebrate one of the most important sports figures in this city and really for basketball. And then in addition to that, it's a double bonus. You got the Golden State Warriors going for their record, you know, league best ever, 73rd game, which they most, barring something, again, really unforeseen, they will take it and they will become the most winningest team in NBA history.
That's right.
So as someone who likes both teams, even though my friends who are fans of both don't think that's possible, it's a good night for television. Unfortunately, both games begin at 7:30, so I'm gonna have to tape one and then watch the other.
Where in the bell curve should an athlete retire?
Mm.
Like where apex, like, you know, like one standard deviation after apex, where?
Right after the apex, don't you think?
Which Michael Jordan did do until he came back and was totally washed up and was playing with the Wizards. So I feel like, yes, you should retire when you're on top. And maybe it's just the moment after the apex, which would include, in this case, someone like Peyton Manning, who is not an effective quarterback anymore. Yet he leaves with a Super Bowl ring. So things worked out pretty well, considering how washed up he looked in this past season with the Broncos. So I think, yeah, you should leave on top.
Agree or disagree, Winter?
You know, I agree with that. You should leave while you're on top. There's nothing worse than watching somebody just aged, really still trying to play the game when they have people up and coming up under them that are doing it better. It's just it's a hard thing to watch. It's even worse to watch when they are actually in the most effective. What am I trying to say? That they're really supposed to be playing excellently, you know, 26 to 28, and they're not even that good. So I'd rather see somebody go out on top.
The problem is, when do any of us know that we're at that apex?
Right.
I think Jordan could have figured it out.
There's also something kind of sweet about, like, those dad baseball players who have just been, this is the only thing they know, and it's the only thing that they do, and they just keep on doing it. Margaret, what are you all about this week?
I'm all about the LA Times Festival of Books.
Yeah.
Yes. I realized, too, that this is so much more my jam than AWP. I talked about AWP last weekend, and I think for me, AWP is so academic and it's so
inside. Tell
everybody
if they didn't listen to last week.
Sure. It's another writing conference that's the Association of Writers and Writing Programs. And basically, it's a much more academic conference in its bent. And the difference is with the LA Times Festival of Books, it's free for one thing, and there are tons of readers in addition to the writers, which to me is just so much more satisfying as an author to actually like interact with people that love to read and not just other writers who kind of are at the same level or some other different level than you. So one of the panels that I went to that was really fantastic was a panel with Mona Simpson, Venda Levita, and Carolina Vokaliak on it. And all three of them are, you know, really wonderful authors. People may know this, but Mona Simpson, her brother is actually Steve Jobs. But she was the sister that the bio family had after, what am I trying to say? How do I say this?
They gave him up for adoption.
Yeah. They gave him up for adoption, and then they got married, and then they had her.
Yeah.
Wow.
The biological siblings, but they didn't grow up together.
Exactly. And she didn't meet him until she was 25. So that's just an interesting bit of trivia about her.
Whoa.
But she has many beautiful, amazing books. Off Keck Road is the one that I know the best, and it's wonderful. Venda Levita has – her latest book is The Diver's Clothes Lie Empty, and she is the kind of writer that really tackles these, like, beautiful, enigmatic woman on a self-discovery kind of tour story. I really recommend it for people that like Haruki Murakami because there are some similarities there of, like, a person who kind of loses their identity or loses some sort of sense of self and has to be has to rediscover it. And then Carolina Wachowiak is an editor at BuzzFeed now, and she has a couple of novels out from $2 Radio, How to Get Into the Twin Palms and The Invaders. And The Invaders sounds super interesting to me. I haven't read it yet, but it's involving a woman who's kind of a trophy wife in Connecticut and who is 42, 43 and really feels like she's losing all of her power, all of her currency as a woman.
Interesting.
That sounds fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Margaret, if there were any good novels that are coming out in the near future that people could pre-order that we should know about, can you think of anything?
I can. So my own novel, Neon Green, is coming out in July. You can pre-order it now on Amazon or even better from your local independent bookstore. And I was also on a panel this weekend, and that was fantastic. Just getting lots of questions from people, and the two other panelists I was with, Andrea Klein and Elizabeth Purser, were both incredible. And yeah, it was just a really great time.
Pre-order Margaret's novel. I already have.
I was cheering on you from my bed. Seriously, with all seriousness, I love you, Margaret.
Winter, what are you all about
proud
this week?
Of you. Real Housewives. Last night, I just happened to catch Real Housewives.
Potomac, right?
Potomac, because of course.
Yeah.
You know, I've been following Real Housewives since Orange County, and you know, you always fall in love with the franchise and a cast. And then they get long in the tooth and you stopped it. You know, the one big Everybody good leaves. And the you know what took me off the whole train completely was the cancer storyline in OC. It basically soured the pond of the rest of them because it's like it's really one trope that is just disgusting that we're a whole season about if you're faking cancer or not. Are you fucking kidding me?
Give me the flavor, the flavor of Potomac. Because it's a predominantly black cast, right?
They're all black women, ranging in light skin to dark, and they were lined up last night on the reunion from darkest to lightest. And it's basically the reason why I like Potomac, particularly about the way they were cast. I think Bravo's being just completely open about the questionable economics. Are they wealthy?
Yes.
Some of them are bankrupt.
Potomac,
some of them,
just from promos, felt like Atlanta meets Beverly Hills. Like,
yes.
They seemed like more legit actually rich.
They seem more legit actually rich, but then it's rich within their socioeconomic space.
Yeah.
So are they wealthy because they all bring in close to $300,000 a year? Sure, but that's where in that region that you live comfortably there. You know, the five women, there's one who's married to a Rutgers coach and they're separated. You never saw the husband. One who's married to somebody who's supposed to be the black Bill Gates of that whole DMV area. There's basketball wives. There's a single mother of three. There's another single mother of three. There's a new trophy wife that has an older husband. But the thing that I like about the show, I think the most, is that this feels the most realistic in terms of the stories, the actual conflict. There's actual conflict. There's not like this made up conflict. There's actual like issues with people presenting themselves different than who they actually are. There's racial tension there's light skin and dark skin.
The thing that was always fascinating is having these people who didn't really know each other then have all of their deep personal issues revolve around each other.
Yeah, like, but these girls actually are familiar with one another.
It's nice when it's more organic. It always felt to me like Beverly Hills, say, was a bit more organic.
Right.
With them being so related to each other than like, you know, New Jersey, where the first couple of seasons it felt made up. Also, while watching the first episode of Real Housewives of New York, my reaction to Bethany Frankel was, bitch, you're not a real housewife. You're an apartment girlfriend.
You're an apartment girlfriend. Okay.
That is a diss.
Oliver, before you say something, I have to say my favorite part of last night was Ashley was arguing something with Robin, and she said the point's moot. We all know what moot is.
Yeah.
The point is moot, and she kept saying it's moot. And Charisse, the most uppity of the group, goes, it's mute. It's mute. And Andy Cohen's was just a bless your heart. He was just like, God. Bless your heart.
All right, what was your... They're launching Real Housewives of Dallas in a few weeks.
Tonight, or last night.
The key question is, what American cities have they not yet fully plumbed the housewife material from?
Major cities?
It's a great question because they tried D.C. and it was terrible. No one wants to watch those women. Like, you need excess.
In Miami.
There was a Real Housewives of Vancouver that was produced. It was not seen here. It was... original, because Canada has to do 25% Canadian content on TV.
Right.
It was the most boring television
sure.
program.
You don't say.
They were all just fine. Oh. They did not fight with each other.
No,
they had enough
Vancouver.
Of a taxation.
It was like an episode of Full House.
Yeah, like it was just fine.
I want to see New Orleans.
I want to see New Orleans, but I don't know how well that would do because who actually has money there? It's all weirdness.
I think we need tech. Tech money.
But the thing is, that's a good call. But will they be dramatic enough?
They won't.
Yeah.
I want to see Phoenix. I would love to see a Scottsdale.
See, that's exactly.
Yeah, thank you.
Golf and conspicuous consumption.
They're really not doing shit all day.
But the very good point that you were
right
making.
For drama.
That you were making about Potomac, that like when, I mean, in San Francisco or New York, just getting by is so expensive that you cannot be that real housewifey.
Right.
In Scottsdale, like, your money goes a lot further.
Sure.
You can be an asshole.
Right, you have to have money to burn majorly.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
This week, I'm all about a show that came out a while ago on Netflix, but I was gone and then other stuff was going on. But it's called Characters. And I love both the show and one specific episode of it. Basically, they took six sketch comics and they let them run free. They said, have a half hour. They said, we'll provide you with the production and support to do what you want to do. And they were all character comics who, most of them created basically like a sketch show. Like, you know, like a bunch of little vignettes with different characters. And the extent to which they did not poke or prod at what these people did and just let them like create what they wanted to is really wonderful because many of them are people I know who I see perform it, like on stage and realizing that this just was their act given sort of like amazing production value was wonderful. But there is one episode. Kate Berlant, who is an amazing comedian, an astoundingly smart and bizarre comedian, did not create a sketch show. She did a half hour pilot, essentially, of what can only be described as Keeping Up with the Kardashians, but for Marina Abramovich.
Oh, my God.
She is.
I want to watch.
I'm watching that right after this show.
It is like family reality show about conceptual artist.
Oh, my God.
Her husband.
This is like a dream that I had that somebody tapped into my brain and realized.
And her daughter is twins who she only gave one name to see if she would develop independent identities.
Oh, my God.
Within that
That's
framework.
That's maybe some childhood cruelty. That's like child abuse. But
it is so good. And the best part is that it feels like it is just making straightforward jokes about high art and corporate sellout status because the sprite integration throughout the episode is just wonderful. But the wonderful thing about Kate Berlant is that she's not taking a baseball bat to an easy target. She is exploring and feeling around and like loving and hating these characters all at the same time. Kate plays both the artist and her gallerist and her husband and her mentor and like the first, because Kate's dad is like a real conceptual artist from Santa Monica, the first like 3 minutes is just a bunch of testimonials from a bunch of legit artists and Alicia Silverstone.
Amazing.
Yeah, just throw her in too.
Yeah.
What's the name of the show again?
It's called Characters, but there are many episodes that are good. John Early, who is a gay comic who I love and respect so much, does an episode where it's a lot of good characters. It's great characters. The frame is him having his own wedding and how unlikable he goes with the character who is called John Early is a thing of rare, rare beauty. But the Cate Berlant episode is the one that you cannot fucking miss because it is just you want to watch that series. You want to watch 10 episodes of this show.
Yeah.
It's so good.
I'm excited.
Sold.
I'm going to watch.
All right. You are listening to Pop Rocket. We will be right back to answer your pop culture mailbag questions right after this.
I listen to Bullseye because it always includes real talk with interesting artists who I might never have heard of otherwise. Each interview includes real honesty from these artists that I don't hear anywhere else.
I'm Jesse Thorne. I'll talk with Ellie Kemper, star of Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt, on the next Bullseye for MaximumFun.org and NPR.
Welcome back to Pop Rocket. I'm your host, Guy Branum. With me in the studio are...
Winter Mitchell.
Margaret Wappler.
And Oliver Wang.
And this week, we thought we would answer some mailbag questions, because we don't do it at the start of the show anymore. And I thought we would open up with some individual questions that people had for us individually. So this question is for Margaret. Margaret, just wanted to say you're my current jam soulmate. Are there any books you would make required reading for school if you could? This question comes from Scott Kersey on the Facebook group.
Let me say first, Scott Kersey, I am so glad to be your soul jam. I'm so glad to be your jam muse. That makes me very happy. So a few books. And I really am recommending this for like high school, college age. There are many wonderful books that are for young adults and middle school, grade school. But I don't know that world as well. So I'm going towards the high school, college kind of area. First is Joe Loya's The Man Who Outgrew His Prison Cell, Confessions of a Bank Robber. So this book is a memoir. It's about a guy who grew up in East LA in the 70s and 80s and really was indoctrinated into this life of crime. Had no choice about it. Grew up in such a raw, scrappy, poverty-stricken way that the only way to sort of get anything in his life was to steal. And he became a bank robber. He gets imprisoned. And then he makes this tremendous turnaround. And the book is really well written. It's so valuable for the fact that it shows how many of us are born into circumstances that cause us to make decisions in our lives that we really don't have a lot of control over. And that, you know, oddly enough, once he's in prison, he kind of gets control of his life. And just as an aside, I met Joe Loya in a very kind of haphazard way where I was visiting a friend in Oakland. And she said, oh, my neighbor's a writer. He's a really great writer. You should just meet him. And I was walking to my car, like getting my bags out. And Joe Loya just walks up to me and we start talking and he just hands me his book. I didn't know anything about him, you know, and I started reading this book and I was blown away. This was several years ago. Another book that I would recommend is Pedro Páramo by Juan Rulfo. It's a really beautiful surrealist book from the 50s that's set in Mexico. And it's basically like every sentence just feels like a beautiful, precise dream. I mean, it's stunning. And because it's so beautiful, I recommend that.
What do you think a like high school required reading book, what should it be? Like what should it have to it?
Well, part of the reason I'm talking about Pedro Páramo, in addition to it just being like structurally, sentence-wise, gorgeous, it's also just an incredible sort of tour into a certain kind of Mexican culture that you can't get any other way. There's a lot of sort of like Catholicism mixed into it. There's a lot of spiritual heft and weight to it because basically this man goes on a journey into a ghost town, a literal ghost town. And so he's meeting all these spirits. And I don't know, there's just like an insight that it gives you into Mexico's culture that you just can't get any other way. So I think that to me is what's really valuable about these books, is that it's a true insight into some kind of culture that maybe you wouldn't know about. The next book is Housekeeping, Marilyn Robinson.
I love that you put this on here.
It's such an amazing book. It's also a movie. It's a book from 1980. It's three generations of women. Part of the reason I put this one on here is because it is so saturated in what it means to be a woman and to sort of have legacies passed down in a domestic way. And when I say domestic, I'm not just talking about housekeeping in the literal sense of the word, but just housekeeping in terms of like, you know, what it means to sort of keep your home together, what it means to keep your family together. So it's another really striking, gorgeous book. I mean, I feel like if you don't like it, I don't know, you're probably a murderer or something.
Oliver, Mighty Pro Jet on the Max Fun subreddit asks, do you still DJ on the regular, and do you curate your playlist for every occasion, or do you have one universal playlist?
So in answer to the first, it depends on what you mean by regular. But for example, in the last couple of months, I've ended up booking at least 3 weddings to DJ this year, which is up from, I think I did one last year. So this is, for whatever reason, 2016 has been a banner year. I still do, you know, parties and club nights on occasion, but I don't have like a regular gig, which I sort of like, if only because when you have to go to work at 10 and get off at 2 a.m., it might be fun a few times, but I used to do a weekly in Echo Park, and I did it for 2 years. And by the end of it, I was so happy when management asked us to stop. I wouldn't have quit it because the money was good, but it was just a drag. It just felt like work, and it felt like work at, you know, again, you get off at 2 in the morning.
Being extremely tired keeps you young. Here's my question for you about DJing.
No, but go ahead.
Here's my question about DJing. Okay, what is your go-to, like, make the ants dance song? Like, get the ants out who are... like, where in a wedding reception do you put it, and how do you get those old ladies who, you know, have now a drink and a half in them and want to get up? What do you get them up with?
I mean, the easy answer is this: Motown. And especially for unless it's
I thought you were going to say Hot in Here.
I should try that. We should make this a bit of a social
experiment.
I
would dance to Nelly.
No, I mean, I you know, Stevie Wonder. There's a handful of things that will always work with Stevie. You could, I mean, probably Michael Jackson. I feel like Michael's almost too easy. Like, that's just shooting fish in the barrel. Because someone asked me also, I think, in the same subreddit, whether or not I have a go-to jam. And there's not one song. But there's a few things where if I absolutely need to get things started, you know, you throw on Rock With You by Michael Jackson or Kiss by Prince, which Jesse Thorne had joked about. But I feel like, again, those songs are perfectly good. It's just kind of cheap because it's so easy.
Older women are getting younger.
Right.
So you can put on Kiss.
Yeah.
And that's going to make them remind them of being 30-something or 20-something.
Right. No, it's a good song for that. Yeah. But in terms of the whether or not I curate my playlist, for any given gig, I definitely will sit down and go through my library and pick out basically a digital crate, if you will, worth of songs that I think might work for that. And one of the fun things about especially working on a wedding, I mean, it's incredibly stressful because there's a lot of pressure on that particular gig. But you also kind of – you get to know the couple that you're working with through their music choices and finding ways, okay, you really love song A. Well, I can use that and then play off of that with song B, C, and D. And that for me, that creative process is really enjoyable.
Cool. Have you seen the mid-90s film Party Girl?
No.
One of the lovely things about it is that it does show the process of a DJ composing the vinyl that he needs for an evening, and uses the Dewey Decimal System to approach it in a way that is lovely. Sylvester was under divas, comma, male.
There you go.
Winter, this question also comes from Scott Kersing on the Facebook group. How has working in social media changed your approach to viewing, listening, entertainment?
This is a really good question. I think that it's just given me an outlet to sort of talk about things that I like and dislike. When I was a kid growing up, it was hard for me to talk about the things that I loved because, and I've talked about this a bunch on the show, but, you know, being like a black girl, liking things that wasn't stereotypical or prototypically black, it made me an outcast. So when I was finally has sort of built up this quote unquote brand and I was able to sort of tweet like things that I love, you find that there's a lot of people that have the same type of likes that you have.
It's the best.
You feel accepted. And like last night, for instance, I tweeted about one of the best lines of Girls ever. Adam tells Jessa that, you know, referencing Sample, his sister's baby, the baby spit up on Jessa. And she started freaking out and saying, help me, help me. And he said, why would you need help? You're an adult. She's a baby. Why do you need more help? And I tweeted that and said, I tweeted the quote and said, I love hate when this show is low key brilliant.
Yeah.
It's the most likes I've gotten
this
in a minute.
This season, by the way, this season's been on fire.
Yeah.
Just
this season's been
in.
On fire. But it's like, it's like when I get, I always get tons of likes on tweets when I feel like I hit something that other people relate to.
Yes.
And it's petty to feel good about likes on a tweet, but I like to feel like when you feel something,
yeah,
other people feel it and it feels symbiotic.
It's like that last episode of Girls is doing something so interesting with point,
yeah,
with point of view,
yeah,
that like you're in those scenes and you're relating to Hannah in such a weird way.
No.
Because she's, you understand her and she's just being terrible.
She's the worst kind of person, but back to the question, like social media for me is an outlet, less so lately. But I've taken sort of a position lately of just sort of being less reactive and more reflective and sort of like looking at what people are saying. It helps me dive into accessing things that I normally would not have paid attention to because I'm always trying to gather data and information, so I'm always trying to see what trends are happening. Uh-huh. But I don't necessarily use social media as a guide per se, and I don't let it really dictate my tastes. I always want to be the first person to sort of tell people about something.
Guy, your work at G4 was so entertaining. I loved every bit when you were on the air. Oh, I shouldn't have read that because it's just a compliment, but I liked it. Could you please tell some hilarious and scandalous stories, at least one from the video game Glory Days? That question comes from Law Threeper on the Maximum Fun subreddit. I mean, nothing really scandalous happened because everybody was just sort of like sensible and doing their job most of the time. I have talked shit about Olivia Munn at other times on this show. I'm not going to do that here. I think one of the most interesting things was the host of X Play, the female host of X Play that I worked on, was sort of nerd famous at a point in social media where nerd famous girls were getting treated way more harshly than like mainstream celebrities, the way that mainstream female celebrities all get treated now. Back in 2006, it was just Morgan Webb having to deal with that. And
I feel like people were pretty kind to Morgan.
But I mean, it was just the thing of like if
she's
she
a lovely girl.
If she held something that looked like a dick, it would immediately be turned
right.
into a gif that
and she
that had
not
a dick.
Like that.
Yeah, and like Morgan is like a wonderful, smart
yeah.
person who went to Berkeley and was just like not having that and not having like an over-sexualized construction of her get shoved at her.
Mm-mm.
So I had to learn things like, you know, there was a Kwanzaa episode and it was like, she can't hold the corn, she'll hold the ethnic studies textbook because that will get turned into a dick. But there was one great moment where I had written copy for her and it was hobbies were something in masturbation. And she's like, I'm not going to say that. And then we pitched around something else. And then she said autoerotic asphyxiation. And I said, that's hilarious, but why is that okay? And she's like, 'cause that's funnier. And I was like, yes, you're right. But the other great story about Morgan Webb is that at the very beginning of this podcast, Jesse was talking to people who he thought were like authorities on pop culture who might be interested. And so one time Oliver and I and Morgan got together and we had a drink and we're talking about this. And Morgan essentially said, I don't pay attention to this stuff enough to be good on this podcast. But you want to know who would be good? Miss Winter Mitchell. So.
Aww,
that little origin story.
Yes.
G4 had an important role in creating this podcast. All right. Let's get to some general questions. Okay. This question is from Luis Alejandro Montero Bermudez on the Facebook group. And his question is, who's your representation in the media? I will sound like an ask. Oh, basically, it says, like, as a bigger.
Another compliment for you, guy.
As a bigger gay guy, he doesn't see a lot of gay guys and stuff. And when he saw me on Chelsea Lately, it, like, connected with him. And I definitely, for me, my mind goes back to this one moment, like, right after I had come out of the closet. I was visiting a friend in New York, and she was recounting a story of her dad describing me as that fat queer Jew. Mm. And I like had this chilling moment of as like a person freshly out of the closet, realizing that I could be so easily reduced by somebody to just a list of words. And this weird moment of like, is that all I am? And then realizing that also describes Harvey Fierstein made it all okay. Like, it just made it all okay, realizing, like, yeah, that does hit a good 70% of who I am. What's wrong with that? Winner, what about you?
You know, it's hard because I didn't have a representation of me growing up, really. And everybody would always say that my mom looked like Oprah. My mom's like 10 shades lighter than Oprah. I don't really have a representation. I've said it before, like, you know, being Mary Jane is the closest representation I have of, like, the experience as a modern Black woman. But I don't really – this sounds fucking crazy, but Jerry Maguire.
Oh, really?
I relate to Jerry Maguire, the entire movie, the entire character, the headspace he's in from the first minute the movie comes on to the very end. I cycle through a Jerry Maguire scenario. I've probably cycled, like, since the movie came out 3 times where I've completely felt every single emotion that Jerry Maguire possesses and exudes and explores in that movie.
Margaret, what about you?
For me, it was the character of Claire on 6 Feet Under.
There
are so many insane parallels between our lives. Her dad drops dead when she's like 15, 16. Same thing happened to me. Her dad was a funeral director. My dad was a minister. Like, there's a lot of crossover in those jobs of, you know, my dad would, half of his job was going to people who were sick or dying or being, you know, part of funerals. Also, the fact that she had this kind of combination of being like surly, which I totally was as a teenager, but also really loving and sensitive, exactly the same profile when I was a teenager. And then she goes on to go to what they call LAC arts on the show, which is Cal arts, which is where I went. And I mean, it just kind of, there's so many moments with her story that I really hardcore related to. There's even that moment where she, like, has a little, like, lesbian fling while she's at art school.
And Margaret!
Yeah. Even that, I was like, lesbian until graduation. I get it.
Winter's just clutching her pearls.
Yes!
But that's a breadth requirement at CalArts, isn't it?
Of course it is! Yeah, like, along with your thesis, you have a little, you dabble a little.
Oliver.
Wait, I need to know, Mark. Do you have the Prius, though? You need a Prius.
I don't have a Prius.
So you need the Prius. That needs to happen.
Oliver, who is your representation?
No, a hearse. That's what she drove.
No, no, but at the end. Like, when she drives off into the desert or whatever the hell, like, she's flashing back 80 years.
Don't remind me of her crying.
I'm an Asian guy. I didn't grow up with any fucking, like, representation that was inspiring. Are you kidding me? So, no, the role models I had that made me think, like, oh, I can do this were not people who...
You could be a bad guy. Or you could be the butt of people's jokes. Have you ever considered being the butt of people's jokes? Or,
you know what? You're right. I'm already there. Now, the person that I probably give the most credit to in terms of giving me planting within me the idea that, oh, this is something that I can do, is Jeff Chang, who is now best known as being an author. But when I first met him, he was a music journalist. He was a hip hop critic. He helped in a lot of, I mean, besides just inspiring me, he also gave me my first gig as a music critic back in, I think, 1994, 95. He ran a record label. He collected records. He's much better at me than a lot of things, especially as a writer. I will wager that I have a better record collection than him now, which makes me kind of proud. So
that's some fighting words.
There has to be a little bit of the killing of the father. Like, you need to feel like you have at least something up on the people who inspire you. But I mean, in all seriousness, Jeff, as another Chinese American guy, when I saw him as a writer, as a journalist, as a critic, I'm like, oh shit, this is something that's possible for me. Yeah, I mean, he really, in a lot of ways, paved the road for me simply by doing it, and it let me know within my own imagination this is something possible. But it certainly wasn't coming from mass media, though.
Ariel Kesweeder on the Facebook group, she wants to know what generally considered cheesy thing from movies, TV, music do you secretly harbor a deep emotional connection to? Oliver, you got a stab at that?
I think this is one of the ones that I sort of have to take a pass in, if only because, I don't know, there's not like, not to get on a particular high horse about it, but there's not a lot in pop culture that I feel like one should be embarrassed about. And to even define something as cheesy, to me, sort of suggests that you are, there's something embarrassing about it.
When we actually started the show, I wanted to do a thing like, what's the thing you consumed from the past year that you are most, from the past week that you're most embarrassed about? And you took a hard stance of like, no, if it's good to you, it's good. And I really appreciated that. Like, I was like, no, because so many of the things that I do like are widely considered to be cheesy or negligible. Like, one of the things that defines me is like,
hotel music.
Not hotel music, but me being willing to sort of like argue for the emotional depth in Ariana Grande song.
Sure.
And
I think it more your taste in music is more like spin class music.
Yeah.
Yes, but I think that stuff
great.
Does have like emotional resonance to it. I mean, cheesy thing that I really love, the song "I Am Woman, Hear Me Roar" is hack. We all know that it is hack. It fucking, like, it makes me cry. It kills me. It kills me to think about, like, what life was like for women in the mid-70s to be able to, like say shit like that. And I love it. What about you?
I think it was considered cheesy, but it's actually really just super incredibly sexist. And I love camp from Italy. So, like, 60s, 70s camp where it's just seriously, like, women over, you know, being over sexualized and men being like, you know, eyes gouging out of their heads, you know, agape looking at these women. And there's a lot of different movies that, you know, they try to do it with Barbarella for America, but there's, you know, Ursula Andress, there's you know, practically any woman that was in an Italian cinema at that time, like Bertolucci films. Anytime a woman basically is in a movie where she didn't, there was no English being spoken, it was purely Italian, and it was all over sexualized, Sophia Loren, anything like that, and it had like the campy music, the sort of 60s, 70s disco. I love that. And I kind of don't look at the way cinephiles look at it, where they're talking about, you know, sort of the way it was shot and that era and the art. And
I love
that,
those Italian sex comedies.
Yeah, I like Italian sex comedies.
I think they're so fun.
Like, I watched 10 today and I was like, it's not an Italian sex comedy, but it's like Blake Edwards. I love all of Blake Edwards' movies, and they're not like thick on being cerebral. They're just total romps.
70s were so weird.
Yeah.
Margaret.
I love a good 80s movie montage. Ooh, yeah. Love it. Like, if especially when it's like a woman getting ready for a date, you know, when she's like putting on the lipstick and curling the hair and putting on the dress and like lifting the boots, like all of it. Just give it all to me.
Here's what bothers me about 1980s, like, getting ready montages is a few too many times they are like soulful and minor key, and like I don't want a Pretty in Pink montage. I want,
what do you mean? Why not?
Did you like her dress? Because I feel like you said you didn't like her dress.
Wait,
the prom
dress? Fucking dress.
Oh, that's terrible.
I hate her fucking dress.
I remember this. Flashbacks. I love that dress.
We all love a good teen comedy, right? I watched 10 Things I Hate About You last night. And not only is it so good, but it was a stunning reminder that Gabrielle Union, in every scene, has like a word and a half, and she makes it
nails it every time.
An entire character, and it's wonderful to watch.
Yeah.
All right. So Andrew Stewart on the Facebook group says, one of my lawyer friends is always jokingly critiquing representations of the law in TV and film. For your given occupation or area of expertise, what was a great example, and what's a really terrible example of that in pop culture? Well, for me, I'll answer two ways, but we'll try to do it quickly. For comedy, every representation of stand-up comedy in almost everything, like Dorothy does stand-up comedy on The Golden Girls or the movie Punchline, they're all terrible and just sort of don't understand what stand-up comedy is. The best representation of what it's like to be a stand-up comedy is a book by a woman named Tess Rafferty called Recipes for Disaster that is like a... Here's a story of 10 parties that I had. They're accompanied by a recipe. It's a lovely book. The recipes are all really good. Part of the problem is that anyone who gets to write about being stand-up either was astoundingly successful or isn't a stand-up. You never actually sort of like see the world from the inside. And Tess's book really gives the feeling of having your regular daytime life and going out at night and doing this other thing and having it feel magical and dangerous and scary. And it's the best. And again, almost everything that represents lawyers doesn't get it. When you're studying for the bar, they will tell you, watch like to practice for professional responsibility, watch any movie about the law and just list all of the professional responsibility violations, and that's a good way of boning up. I maintain the best pop culture representation of lawyering is American Crime Story, and I realize it just happened.
Wow.
But I feel like nothing else that I have seen really makes you understand what the process of lawyering is like. Like, usually you are just talking about clues and facts and good guys, bad guys, but the fact that you actually were arguing motions about admissibility, like that you were talking about ethical issues, it was because it was a real case and something that had 10 hours to breathe. I really think it's amazing. Margaret, do you have any answers for good or bad representations of journalism?
I remember when House of Cards, and I don't watch, so I don't know this character that well, but I remember when House of Cards had a reporter a couple of seasons back who was romantically entangled with a source, and people were really pissed off about it. Like, so many of my journalist friends, especially the women, were like Facebooking about, like, God, can we just stop showing journalists like sleeping with their sources? I actually personally don't have a problem with it at all. I think it's funny. It's just ridiculous. It's like a kind of, to me, it's like, I also, this is also coming from a bit of my like fiction writer side and creative writer side of like, what else are you going to do with a journalist character to give it some sort of drama? One of the options is you have them sleep with the source.
Yeah.
So I don't get offended by that. And really, I don't, in general, I just don't get offended by unsavory representations of lady journalists, because I feel like, you know, there's so many of us and there's so many good movies. His Girl Friday, and you were talking about Being Mary Jane, right? I mean, there's so many good ones that it doesn't upset me when there's a bad one in the bunch.
Right.
What do you have? Can you think of any, like, you're saying those were your good ones. Sorry.
Well, I was going to add, though, too, that, like, I think one of the most funny ones to me for just being ridiculous is Lois Lane. Because Lois Lane just makes idiotic decisions all the time as a reporter.
She got like, trapped in a fault line.
Yes. I mean, she just throws herself in the line of danger constantly in ways that are actually kind of idiotic if you're a reporter to do that. I mean, there's like getting in the middle of it and then there's like not dying.
I believe,
you know, she would have died already.
She's now won a Nobel and Pulitzer Prize.
Oh,
so
right.
You have, Margaret, you can speak about Lois Lane. Oliver, thoughts on academics or DJs?
I wanted to quickly riff off of Margaret's, which is that relationship in the first season of House of Cards produced probably top three most awkward oral sex scenes in the history of television.
Ew. Wow, that's saying something.
So with professors, I would say this is both kind
that
of slightly best slash worse, which is the English workshop professor in Todd Solondz's, I think it was Storytelling, where they basically just have students read off a piece of writing and then people just lay into it and completely eviscerate it. And then he also like sleeps with his white students and has them call him racial epithets, which is all weird and very Todd Solondz. I mean, it's wholly unrealistic, especially in this day and age. That professor would not last a heartbeat with the kind of harshness of the critique. But on a fantasy level, we all want to basically tell our students, you know, your shit sucks. It's terrible. Because it's true. If you feel that way, you're like, yeah.
Oliver.
You are breaking the undergrads' hearts right now.
Have you graded undergrads
papers?
No,
I haven't, actually.
Okay. All right. Then step back.
They
do break your heart. It's true.
What's a terrible professor? A terrible...
I feel like most of them are usually presented because it's hard to make a professor interesting. And so you
need to watch Shameless this season.
Oh,
seriously.
Oh, okay, maybe.
Yeah.
So they have to have some kind of drinking problem or drug problem while they're sleeping with their students.
Yeah, Shameless. Ding, ding, ding.
Best example, just in terms of sartorially, Indiana Jones.
Wow.
It's great outfits. Winner.
I've had like five iterations of a career in Hollywood, so I kind of like sum this up for Hollywood. I think the best representation of just working in Hollywood as a young person, Swimming with Sharks.
Mm. Oh, yes. That is like, it's interesting to go back and watch some of that stuff about the entertainment industry after you've actually been here.
Well, it basically set me up, that and The Operator and a bunch of other books set me up for what I to expect. And it basically, that's what happened. But I'm like friends with my boss now. It's interesting.
Swimming with Sharks, for those of you who don't know, is a mid-90s independent film where Kevin Spacey plays a dickbag of a producer.
And Frank Whaley is his assistant.
Yeah, who basically takes him prisoner and tortures him the way that he was tortured.
Right. And then The Player, just sort of understanding. I love Tim Robbins in The Player more than anybody in that movie because he is so like self-important, but also like doesn't really trust his instinct. And then the whole, my favorite scene is when he walks up to Burt. I'm sure I've said this before. Walks up to Burt Reynolds and says, "Hey, Burt, it's so and so." And he's like, Burt's like, "Hey, how's it going?" He's like, "Who the fuck is that?" So that's sort of like, you know,
that's Hollywood in a nutshell.
That's Hollywood
right there.
In a nutshell. Entourage, I've always said, I will stand for and ride for Entourage. It's exactly what it was like working inside of an agency.
But who are you?
Lloyd.
Okay.
Always Lloyd. But just like in terms of like, it, you know, a lot of my career sort of exploded and in whatever way you want to take that by working in this business. And so one of the one good thing besides knowing how to do my job and exist in whatever iteration that my career is at that time is understanding how to sort of navigate the system. And it's hard. I don't always do my best because I'm an emotional person, but it is also interesting when you can know how to talk to talent, know how to talk to the studio heads, whatever.
What piece of media, song, movie, TV show, musicals, do you wish you could go back and experience again for the first time? For me, it is the Mike Leigh movie, Topsy Turvy. It was just such a journey of delight. And I didn't know Gilbert and Sullivan when I saw it for the first time. And I was learning about that while sort of like falling in love with the whole story, Oliver.
I mean, there's so many albums that I could answer for this. So this is not like my absolute number one. It's just A1. But I would love to be able to go back to 1994 and listen to Nas's Illmatic for the first time again.
Margaret.
I had dinner with a friend last night, and she was saying that she got tickets to see LCD Sound System
Pomona
tonight. And it really, I've seen them like 5 or 6 or 7 times or something in concert. And it reminded me, oh, my God, if I could go back and see them again for the first time, I would do it.
Winner.
I would go back and watch Nightmare on Elm Street for the first time. It was the first horror movie. I would watch that shit again. That gave me nightmares for literally 2 weeks.
All right. What pop culture did your parents make sure that you knew and loved? Beatles.
Tina Turner and James Brown.
Simon and Garfunkel.
My parents weren't into pop culture, so the answer would be nothing.
All right. What was your very, very first jam? For me, it was the Al Stewart song Time Passages, which I thought was about flying sausages.
Hey Mickey,
the Beatles, I Want to Hold Your Hand, and I knew how to reset the record player to go exactly to that song.
Exactly.
I should have prepped for this one better. I can't think of off the top of my head. Probably something by ABBA or maybe the Bee Gees. Probably the Bee Gees.
ABBA's so great. All right, you guys, you're listening to Pop Rocket. We will be right back with a very specific flavor of jam after this.
Podcasts.
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 They're audio programs that
tell smart stories
in innovative ways
using editing techniques like this. This.
Like this.
Like this. Like this. Yeah.
But let's face it, all that smart stuff can be exhausting.
That's where Stop Podcasting Yourself comes in.
It's so stupid.
It's just two stupid dinguses
being dumb idiot jerks for 90 minutes.
Stop Podcasting Yourself.
The stupid show that smart people love.
Find it on iTunes.
Or MaximumFun.org.
Welcome back to Pop Rock. I'm your host, Guy Brandon. With me in the studio are...
Winter Mitchell.
Margaret Wappler.
Oliver Wang.
Now, Oliver, every week on Pop Rocket, we ask the panel, what's your current jam? But this week... In honor of Stephanie Murray on the Facebook group and she honoring the return of baseball, she asked for us to say what our walk-on music would be. Tell the world about walk-on music.
Walk-on music is a great tradition where when a batter comes up to step to the plate, they get a few seconds of a song that is their walk-on music. It's supposed to be sort of like their anthem, basically. And there's a lot that one can do by analyzing the various walk-on song selections by different professional baseball players.
All right. What would yours be?
This is a song I've always wanted to use either as walk-on music or as a shootout action scene in a movie. It is Cyril Neville's Gossip.
I could see Martin Scorsese using this in a shootout scene of some kind.
So that's the Meters in the background. Cyril Neville, a member of the Meters. It's the only single he ever put out, and it's a killer A-B-side New Orleans funk thing, and that intro just has to be used by someone for something at some point in time.
That's so great. Margaret, what would you walk on Music Bay?
Well, I need something that's going to give me some swagger, and it's going to make me feel sexy, and it's going to make me, like, just look out all the rest of the opposite team and think, I'm going to kill you. So I picked Diamond Dogs by David Bowie. This ain't nothing, no. This is genocide.
Windsor, what would you walk on Music Bay?
Oh, that's easy because I played softball. And I was a catcher. Ovs. Mine would be Control by Janet Jackson.
This is a story about control. My control. Control of what I say, control of what I do. And this time I'm going to do it my way.
And I want lights like the WWE before I even get to bat.
Wait, is this some song where in the video she, like, dances with the chair the whole time?
No, that's Pleasure Principle.
Yes, okay.
I want, like, lights and beams and everything and the diamond
fog sparkles, machine.
Like the fog machine.
Winter just comes out through the haze.
Yes,
out.
Definite fog machine.
I want, like, a robe that you pull off and everything. Yeah, I would kill this. Right straight into the fucking rafters, baby.
And my walk on music... I figured probably the closest thing I have to walk on music is when I do my live talk show, the game show. We've got one that's going on at Nerd Melt on April 18th at 8:30. So come to that if you can.
What?
But the walk on music I use for that is this. That song is Barat by Michael Dana. It is the opening credit sequence of Monsoon Wedding. And I like Indian wedding music, and it sounds like a good time is about to happen. And when I come out, a good time is about to happen. All right, you guys. You've been listening to Pop Rocket, hosted by me, Guy Branum, with Winter Mitchell, Margaret Wappler, and Oliver Wang. We post our show notes every week at MaximumFun.org, and you can also find links to the episode description on the podcast. Our theme music is Party Booby Trap by Ozzy Muzo. Thanks to him for letting us use it. Thanks to Jamie Rasconi, Kiara Moe, CC45, and Sing It Back for the new 5-star reviews on iTunes. If you haven't already, please review us. If you guys have an opinion you want to share about this week's topic, you can join the conversation on our Facebook group or tweet at us. We are at Pop Rocket. And also, thanks again to everybody who asked questions, whether we use them or not. We had a bunch more that we wanted to get to, but we talk forever. We are a production of MaximumFun.org, and our producers are the non-present Colin Anderson, the much-beleaguered Christian Duenas.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist-owned.
Listener-supported.